In today's episode, C.S. Poe talks about the end of a series, and Justine talks about another series she doesn't want to end.
Welcome to Gay Mystery Authors with Brad Shreve, featuring interviews with some of the most renowned authors and up-and-coming talent in LGBTQ mysteries, suspense, and thrillers. Plus, Justine Adamek is here with her weekly recommendation.
Hey, Brad, how far in advance do we have guest book right now?
You know, it's pretty amazing. Once I announced this show was coming on, the request for to be interviewed went crazy. Right now, I'm actually booked up until March. We have a couple people booked in March even. Certainly popular with the authors, and we're assuming that means it's going to be popular with the readers. I'm excited about how we're going out the gate here. How's it going with you getting books to review?
Well, that's the exciting thing, because we have the guest book, but people can still get heard on the show by sending their books so that I can review them. And each week I'm going to review a book. We have several books in the pike, both books that I've picked up on my own and then books that people have submitted for review. And if an author wants to submit a book, they can send it to info@gaymysteryauthors.com. I read them all. I can't review them all because we don't have any more review spots than we have guest spots. But we're hoping to double up our selection of authors.
And it's important to note that if somebody has their book reviewed on the show, they can still be a guest later.
That's right.
So it doesn't have any effect on whether or not they'll be a guest. We're happy to review their book. And if they want to be on the show and we have an opening, there we go.
Well, you picked the guests and I picked the books to review. And occasionally we overlap, but there's a wide variety of people that we find independently.
Exactly. So that generally it's not a problem. So Justine, what book are you recommending this week?
I'm recommending the 10th and last book in the Hart series by Robert Innes. Blake Hart is his detective, and his last name is spelled H-A-R-T-E, and the 10th book is entitled H-A-R-T-E. And it's an unfortunate that this series is going to end. On Facebook, he has said that he hopes that the series isn't going to end. But you know how that is as an author. The characters may talk to you, the characters may not. And he's tied up a lot of arcs in this book.
It's kind of like an actor can never really retire because they never know when the best script is going to show up at their
exactly.
door.
These have all been novellas. And the great thing about it is not only is it a whodunit, it's a howdunit. The books remind me of Encyclopedia Brown. Have you ever read those stories?
Oh, not only do I remember reading those stories, I loved Encyclopedia Brown. He pissed me off a lot because sometimes I didn't solve the mystery. I would say he wasn't the catalyst to get me to write, but he certainly was one of the catalysts to make me want to write mysteries.
Well, he certainly was one of those catalysts to make me want to read mysteries. And it's hard to find puzzles that are as clever as those Encyclopedia Brown puzzles, but most of these puzzles are right up there. In fact, all of these books are right up there with Encyclopedia Brown. In one book, they're chasing a suspect and the lights go into a tunnel and then they come out the other end and the car is not there. In another book, the murder victim drowns in an elevator without any water in it.
Well, that's unusual.
Certainly is. And he solves all these cases, but somehow his boss, as well as the other police detective who is the same rank as him, never give him any credit, never give him any slack, and complain all the time about, you know, he's going off and on his own, and I don't know how many more things he has to solve before they managed to give him his credit. But we'll see. Perhaps that'll be the future series.
I worked in a corporation. It was the same way. So it doesn't surprise me. The police force is that way. Now, you said this is number 10, and you mentioned some of the others. If I haven't read any of the others, is 10 going to stand alone for me? Will I enjoy it?
Yes, I think it stands alone. It's like picking up an Agatha Christie book. You kind of have to know who the characters are. Maybe you know who Hercule Poirot is, but you don't need to. Any one of them in the series will serve well as the first one, and this is no different. He's got some arcs that he ties up. I mean, at the beginning, he's moved to this small town after closing a case on a serial killer. That case comes back to haunt him. His partner, Sally, from the larger town he left, comes back to this book. And what really is the key is a bad dream he's been having. When he was a young boy, he crawled into a boarded up house on a dare from a friend, ended up finding an old woman sitting in a rocker with her throat slit. That case was never solved, and it's been haunting him ever since. In this final book, he gets to the bottom of it.
We always want to start with book number one, and I'm sure Robert would not complain if people start with number one at all. But I appreciate when I can pick up a book anywhere in the series and still be able to jump in and get into that book. So I'm happy to hear that he does that.
Yeah, it works very well. So
any news?
Wait, you need my recommendation.
Oh my goodness. I was going to move forward. Yes. What is your recommendation with this?
This one gets an intriguing recommendation.
Intriguing.
Yes. You know, all my books that I review are 5 stars. So we've got a series of recommendations. A glowing recommendation, a flaming recommendation, an intriguing recommendation, and a touching recommendation. I may add more later on, but intriguing recommendation is one where the puzzle and the mystery is really good.
So, Robert Innes has an intriguing recommendation from you. Any news from Requeered Tales this week?
Requeered Tales is putting out Grant Michael's series. People who have been reading classic gay fiction when it was published really loved this series, and we're hoping to bring it out to a whole new generation. It follows a hairdresser who solves mysteries. The second book we've put out, it involves a chocolate factory, and we're going to bring back all 7 books in the series.
All 7 books? That's a big win for
you. Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Great to hear. I'm glad how well you guys are doing.
And you're doing CS Poe today.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I am.
I'm looking forward to hearing it. Talk to you next week, Brad.
We're sponsored by Requeered Tales, preserving our LGBTQ literary heritage, one book at a time. Check them out at requeeredtales.com.
Our guest today is C.S. Poe, and I'm very happy to have her join us today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
C.S. Poe is a Lambda Literary and 2-time Epic Award finalist and a FAPA Award-winning author of gay mystery, romance, and paranormal books. She has an affinity for all things cute and colorful and a major weakness for toys. C.S. is an avid fan of coffee, reading, and cats. She's rescued 2 cats. Milo and Casper do their best on a daily basis to distract her from her work. C.S. is a member of the International Thriller Writers Organization, and her debut novel, The Mystery of Nevermore, was published by DSP Publications in 2016. It's hard to imagine your debut is only 2016. You've accomplished quite a bit in a few years.
It feels like it was a really long time ago. And then I look at the calendar and I'm like, oh no, not really too much, actually.
No, it was many books ago is what it was.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with the Snow and Winter series, talk about them, which Mystery of the Bones is your 4th book.
Now, right.
Your primary characters are Sebastian Snow and Calvin Winter.
Yes.
Tell us about Sebastian.
So Sebastian is the main character of the series. It's all from his point of view. And he is an antique dealer. He lives and works in New York City. He owns his own business in the East Village. And the whole series begins at around Christmas time, and him having the extraordinary bad luck of accidentally finding dead people, usually around the Emporium. And it just sort of snowballs from there into meeting one of the homicide detectives, Calvin Winter, and then life just gets crazier book to book.
Well, it's funny, in Mystery of the Bones, Sebastian receives a decapitated head in the mail.
Yep.
He just can't avoid murder or trouble, can he?
He can't. And, you know, in book one, he sort of revels in it because he's all about trying to prove that he's very smart and that he's capable of solving great mysteries, because he's got a bit of an ego and a bit of a self-deprecating sort of sensibility about him. You know, book two, he continues on that path. Book three, he really tries to stop and behave and be a good citizen. And book four, he, you know, absolutely wants nothing to do with it. And he still finds a way back in every time.
One thing I find interesting, and I'll let you give the medical term, Sebastian has color blindness.
Yes, it's achromatopsia.
I'm glad you said that. But what's interesting is you state in your biography that you have affinity for all things cute and colorful.
Yes.
How did you come up with the idea for him to have color blindness?
It was, you know, I do a lot of research about pretty much any subject that I come across that seems vaguely interesting. And that just ended up being one of these weird rabbit holes I fell down in, like, 2012, I want to say. Who knows what I started researching, and I just stumbled upon that, and I was just thought, how fascinating is it to, first off, no one knows about this condition really, but to shed light on it, because it is a real disorder that people live with. But from just a writer's point of view, how can you describe the world and make it beautiful, avoiding every color description possible?
Well, you've done a great job of that. I find it unique and fascinating.
Thank you.
Part of his character. Now, tell us about the relationship between Sebastian and Calvin.
So Sebastian, you know, is the main character. Calvin is a homicide detective with the NYPD. And they meet in Nevermore when he finds a heart under the floorboards. And Calvin is the detective on the case trying to figure out why there's a heart in the floorboards and who this amateur sleuth wannabe even is. So they don't start out with the best relationship. It sort of grows from there, but yeah, they were not great friends when they met.
Which is somehow some of the best relationships begin anyway.
Yes, I think so. I love a little bit of hate turning into love.
Now, what would Sebastian Snow tell us about C.S. Poe?
That she's as sarcastic as he is and probably can't be trusted. His sarcasm is one of the things that I really like writing about his character. He does actually have, in his weaker, more human moments when he's not cracking jokes, he does have a lot of self-esteem issues that he's carried with him for a long time, and he does use sarcasm as a shield. But just from my point of view, or as a writer, I love writing sarcastic, really, really dry humor, just because that's how I am most of my life. So getting to focus that sometimes not mean but kind of borderline mean jokes through him is a fun outlet.
Well, I tend to have a sarcastic sense of humor as well, and I think you're right. I think it is a shield sometimes. But it being that way, it is what endeared me to him very much. Now, you told me you do a substantial amount of research on Victorian America.
Yeah.
What is the strangest thing you've ever had to research for your books?
Oh, boy. It's such a loaded question. Because I do so much research, I mean, every day. One of the things that I do in my Facebook group for readers is I try to post interesting facts for them every day. and it's usually about the 1800s. So I come across something interesting like every day. But if I had to say one of the more interesting things that made it into a book, probably Snow and Winter Book 3 was about the history of film. And I would say getting to research some of the very first films ever shot was great. They were pretty much, pornography and cats. Nothing much has changed.
That's funny. And I presume your affinity towards things Victorian is probably the reason why you have him running an antique store.
Yeah. It's just, it's a time period that I just find so fascinating. There's just so many bizarre, crazy things that happened in that time period. And so getting to use his shop as an excuse to research it every day is quite fun.
Now you, out of your different novels, other than just Calvin and Snow, they take place in New York, New England towns, and also Key West, Florida.
Yep.
Why specifically those three areas?
They're all places that I've lived. I grew up in northern New Hampshire. I lived in New York City for about a decade. I'm in Key West currently, going back to New York. I've lived in Japan. So I just like writing about places that I've lived.
Do you live currently in Key West, or are you on vacation?
Yes. No, I currently live here.
I'm envious. I always wanted to go. I was at a conference in Miami, and I tried to drive to Key West, and I got halfway there and realized I didn't have enough time to get there and get back. So I had to turn back. So that's as close as I've gotten to your home.
It's an interesting place. It's strange because it's got such a famous sort of culture and vibe to it. But when you really get down to the nitty gritty, it's a small town like northern New Hampshire. It's just a little hotter.
Mm-hmm.
So writing the book that took place in Key West was fun because you got to deal with all of the small town personalities.
Do you get tired of Jimmy Buffett music?
Yes. Yes, I do.
I heard he even regrets writing Cheeseburger in Paradise. So.
Oh, boy. Yeah. If I want to walk down Duval Street and do some shopping, you have to walk by the Jimmy Buffett restaurant. And there's just a whole bunch of, certain age set of tourists there and very, very loud Jimmy Buffett music. And I'm just like, oh, I don't want to be here. Keep walking, walk faster.
Given the different areas, what do you find different about writing about each one? And how do they affect the mood of each novel?
Oh, wow. Yeah. See, the reason I love writing different locations is because a city or a town or anything, a geography is a character in a book as much as the actual people who speak and talk and do things. Small towns have, that charm aspect, which I enjoy, but I kind of get bored of if I do it too often. So most of the stuff I write takes place in New York because you can write sort of the grit and the dirt and the grime and the being sort of anonymous in a city of 8 million people. But when it comes down to hyper-focusing on a neighborhood, such as in Snow and Winter, the East Village, he ends up knowing a lot of people. He knows, his business owners by first name. He knows the lady that drops off the packages. He knows his annoying neighbors. So it's this sort of small town within a huge city. The personality of the setting is very different from an island to an urban environment to a small town. And those are just really interesting to explore, especially when you get readers, messaging you and emailing saying, I used to live here. This is exactly what it's like. Or, wow, you must have done your research. And yes, I did. I lived there for 10 years.
Well, when you mentioned Key West in one of your novels, you kind of lit up a little bit. Can we expect more of that in the future?
I never say never. All of my writing is done completely by the seam of my pants. I start off going, I'm going to write a murder mystery. And people be like, okay, where's it happening? What's it about? I have no idea. I will let you know when I get there. So there could be another one that took place in that world with those characters. I really liked it. But I won't really know until I get that right gut feeling that that's the story and it has to be told. So for now, it's a standalone, long story short.
Okay. Well, I didn't know if you're going to do a different story. Now, you have a background in film production, which I believe it shows in your writing, because your ability to paint a scene is incredible.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. In what ways have you utilized those skills to write a novel?
Well, there's this thing, I don't know, some people might be aware of this. When you write a screenplay for the screen, you have to have the white of the paper and the black of the text be even. If there's too much white or there's too much black, you're supposed to go back and amend it, because each page is roughly about a minute of screen time. So there's these concepts behind it, but it really taught me the importance of less is more, which is something that I'm all about with my writing. If I can tell a setting or an emotion or the dialogue in a single sentence versus five sentences, I will, just because I like the impact of it. And I feel that it sometimes the brashness or the abruptness of the way that I write kind of represents how you have to get to the point in a screenplay.
It's interesting that you say that, because I interviewed somebody that used to be a poet the other day and said mm-hmm. the same thing, that because of having to use a few words in poetry, they were able to use that in your writing. And it sounds
almost identical
to what you're saying.
Yeah. It's all about getting to the point very fast while still maintaining, you know, the importance of what's being delivered.
We said that your first novel came out in 2016, just 3 years mm-hmm. ago. What would you say has improved significantly in your writing or in general?
I think my dialogue has gotten a little better. Dialogue's my favorite thing to write. And I just think cutting out those little annoying words that you use that are repetitive, the that's and the just, the us and the ers out of a character's speech kind of gets it more to the point quickly. Yeah, I mean, there's like a lot of little things. Like, I look back at Nevermore and I really like it. Is there stuff I'd change? Of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that I have done better at getting to the point quicker over the years.
Well, I'm similar to you. Dialogue is my favorite thing to write. My first draft is almost just entirely dialogue. And then I have to go in and fill in the blanks, just because I have so much fun with it. And it sounds like you do too.
Yeah, I love dialogue.
Well,
if I can tell the whole story of just talking.
Yeah, it's easy to get caught up in it. So your writing journey, how did that begin?
I think a lot of authors probably have similar things. You know, I started writing when I was very young. And I mean, I did. When I was probably 12 is when I decided this is something I want to do professionally and get paid for. But I know that I'm only 12 and I'm not very good at it. So it was very much a sit down and write something every single day, because I knew I had to practice to get better at it, because it's an art form, just like sculpting and painting. You have mm-hmm. to practice. And even by 2012, when I came up with the idea for Nevermore, I knew it was a good idea. And all of the attempts that I had done on the book were okay, but I knew it wasn't something that I would ever want to charge someone money for. So mm-hmm. it took until 2015 before it almost felt like all the gears just suddenly locked into place. And I was like, holy crap, I've actually finally figured out what my voice is. It's gritty and sarcastic. And usually there's a lot of dead bodies involved. And I mean, yeah, but it probably took, God, 12 years of just daily practice before I got to that point that I was willing to submit a book to a publishing house.
And the fact that you got the idea for the story in 2012.
Yeah. So
it took you 3 to 4 years to get that first novel to where you were happy with it, which becomes much quicker with time.
It does.
What scenes have you written that made you shudder?
Shudder in a bad way?
Yeah, just given the type of novels that you write.
Oh, like
not shudder in a bad way, like impact.
But you, I can't believe I wrote that. Like, wow, that was intense.
Yes.
In Snow and Winter 3, Sebastian finds a dead body in a dumpster outside of the Emporium, mm-hmm. which was pretty gross. Because he had gone to go close the lid so that it didn't stink up the alleyway, and he slipped in a, there was blood on the railing, and he slipped on it, and after he saw the body, and then fell off and landed in blood, and then he became part of the crime scene. So that was pretty gross.
Just the type of scene I love, too.
Yeah.
What would you say was the hardest scene to write out of everything that you've written?
Oh, let's see. It definitely would have been one of those heartbreaking, emotional moments. I think it's probably in the third Snow and Winter book. Again, a lot of like turning points in the whole series happened in that book. And that's the first time that he kind of lays himself totally bare. He has pretty much an emotional breakdown with his father and just lays out all of his fears and insecurities that he's been too afraid to tell everybody, even his own dad. And that was a rough scene to write, because it was just so draining. When I finished that, I was like, I'm going to go take a nap now. Jesus.
You've got a really good relationship with your readers. You on Facebook, you're very active with them. What was the most rewarding thing that you've heard from a reader?
The very first message I ever got from a reader was about a week or so after Nevermore came out. And it was from a grandmother. And she said, I just wanted to let you know I read this book and I loved it. But I wanted to say I really appreciated it because my grandson has achromatopsia. And the way that you presented it and made Sebastian the hero really made me as the grandmother very happy to see him represented. And I thought that was incredible. And actually about a month ago, I got another message from the director and the VP of marketing of a nonprofit organization that funds the research for achromatopsia to ask me why I had written that and to thank me for representing their community within our community. And I just thought that was incredible. So hands down, like the most important moments so far for me as a writer were those messages.
You know, it's always great to hear writers say, I love your books, but I would mm-hmm. imagine those would be especially rewarding.
Yeah, especially when you're bridging two communities that can definitely feel, you know, not represented and out of place. And when they come together in a single moment where they say, thank you for repping me and I see you and you see me, it's pretty cool.
Now, have you ever been faced with the choice of whether to write what you want or to make it marketable?
No, I don't think so. Because I think what I write is by its default pretty marketable. And I say that though because I went to film school. I have a BFA in film production, and film school has this very unique situation. There are two types of film students. There are the indie kids who feel that you sell out if you do anything to make money, mm-hmm. which is interesting because I like to eat and food costs money. And then there are the quote Hollywood kids who like to make, you know, the quote unquote blow up action adventure movies. And for some reason that was always looked down upon. I was one of the Hollywood kids, not because it was a sellout or to make money, but because those were kind of movies I liked. I liked the car chases and the gunfights and, you know, the action adventure hero saving the day, like Die Hard, one of the best movies ever. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I kind of use that same style when I write. It's dramatic. It's a bit over the top. It's a little silly sometimes. And it has a market. So I don't think I've really been put in a situation where I had to kind of pick what I really wanted to write versus what I wanted to make money on. Maybe I will in the future. Mm-hmm. But just coming from that film background, that was always something that I dealt with. Were you indie and hip or were you Hollywood?
Well, it sounds like you definitely write what you would enjoy reading. And I yes. think if you do that, then you kind of don't fall into that situation of, will this
sell? Right, because you already love it. And if you can talk about what you written with that joy and that love being a parent, people are naturally drawn to it. They want to find out why you're so excited about it.
Since you've been writing such a short time, but you've had incredible success, for aspiring writers out there, what would you say are some common traps?
Common traps. Not practicing enough. Just because you get one book done doesn't mean that you don't need to practice anymore. I mean, I still practice every day. You don't have to write good words every single day. I know some people are really good at it, but that doesn't mean that everyone has to be good at it. You know, I wrote 4 words today. It happens. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow I might write only 500. The next day I might not write anything. I mean, sometimes you just have to deal with it coming and going like that. And I would say, don't fall into the trap of someone else's abilities. They've worked long and hard to figure out what works for them. If they are really good at consistently writing 1,500 words a day, every single day, that's great for them. But if it's not working for you, don't think you're a failure. Practice every day and figure out what routine works for you. Don't judge yourself based on someone else. Because that was something that I felt I was doing wrong in the beginning, was I was a very slow writer. Again, like 500 words a day, it's not a lot. And it takes a while to finish a novel at that speed. But it ended up, that's my speed. I can't rush it because I go back and delete all those words the next day. So you just have to be accepting of what your own abilities are.
Great advice. I tend to be a slow writer as well. And I also dread that a reader will someday find my first drafts. Would be very
keep those
scary.
Under lock and key, right?
Definitely. Put them in the safe. Give me your 30-second spiel on this book.
On The Mystery of the Bones?
Yes.
It is Christmas time once again. It's been a full year since Sebastian and Calvin have met. They've survived many murders, many mysteries, many attempts at killing Sebastian for being too curious for his own good. He is done with solving mysteries until another one is landed on his doorstep. And despite refusing, this individual has escalated to the point of danger that involves Calvin. And now Sebastian is going to be forced to solve a mystery.
What if the readers want to reach you or buy your books? What's the best way to do so?
They can reach me across all social media, pretty much. I'm on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You can find me on Goodreads, BookBub, my website, cspo.com. And my books are available at all third-party vendors. So that's Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Google Play, iBooks, Kobo. You can find me pretty much anywhere.
So you're easy to find.
I am very easy to find.
Are any of the social media ones that are best to try and get a hold of you?
Facebook, I'm probably on the most. That probably has the most traction. Twitter, I'm pretty easy, but I don't go on as much just because it can be a little volatile sometimes.
Yes, I have promised myself this week I am not getting on Twitter. There's no way this week that I'm doing so.
I feel you.
I have something here that I didn't tell you about. With every guest, I ask a question that authors hate.
Okay.
So we're going to spin the wheel here and see what we come up with.
Okay.
Okay. Here's what we've got. What do you plan to do when you're done with this whole writing thing?
No. Probably be dead, because that will be when I stop. Oh, that's already one of those questions. Oh, yeah, I'll be dead.
That's good to hear, because it's great that you put out your books here. I've enjoyed them. I've read the first book and the fourth book. I skipped 2 and 3.
But at least you got a basic understanding of what's going on.
Oh, definitely, definitely. They're a fun read.
Thank you.
Well, I definitely want to thank you for your time and appreciate you being on the show.
Yes, thank you for having me.
And I hope to have you back soon when your next book or one of the future books comes out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I have many more mysteries coming out in 2020. Apparently, I have to write them first. But yeah, they're supposed to come out in 2020.
How do you have many books coming out in 2020 when you're writing 500 words a day?
They're on the production schedule with due dates, so I assume they're coming out.
Okay. One way or another, you've got to make it happen.
Yeah, one way or another. I also don't write very long novels. That helps. They're about 60,000 words.
I think that's pretty common decent. For a mystery.
For a mystery, yeah.
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 All right. Well, thank you again for being on the show.
Yes, absolutely.
And hope to see you next year when the other books come out.
Thank you.
If you have an idea to help improve the show or would just like to make a comment, go to our website, gaymysteryauthors.com. Click the link for contact. You'll find a number that you can call and leave a message, or you can just fill out the contact form. We look forward to hearing from you.
Go to our website, gaymysteryauthors.com, for links to subscribe on your favorite podcast applications so you don't miss a single episode. You'll also find transcripts of this and other shows. We're here every week. Thank you for listening.